Now, the voices of Bronco Athletics, Bob Beeler and Chris Lewis on Sports Radio 93.1 FM and 1350 AM, The Ticket.
Yesterday at 3 o'clock when we were signing off and Caves and Prater were taking over, Leon Rice joined him for a half an hour of discussion on Boise State basketball, college basketball in general, Mountain West looking ahead to the scheduling, to recruiting, and it was a very good half an hour. We've kind of boiled it down today to hit some of the highlights that Caves and Prater hit with Coach Rice. And I think this year when you bring a coach in at the end of the season, it's a season that maybe as the season was building, and I kind of have the high water mark as winning the 20th game of the season to go to 20-4 at New Mexico, coming back from the dead to win that game, and then finishing going 3-5 in the last eight. To me, the season looked like it was going to finish and climax a little bit stronger. It was a great season, but when you lose in the first round of the conference tournament, I think it makes people leave wanting a little bit more.
It was a sudden ending, mm-hmm. and it's almost as if the NIT game didn't happen. It was just so lost in the shuffle.
I think that the thing that hurt the NIT game was the game should have been in Boise.
Yeah.
It was not because of the NCAA tournament, and I think everyone was so focused on the NCAA games that were in Boise. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people really didn't pay a whole lot of attention to the Washington game, and I feel pretty strongly saying this. If that game was played in Boise, I think the Broncos win it. Every other team won at home in the first round in the NIT.
Wow, so that was a pretty interesting footnote there. But, yeah, that's why I said going into the NIT, the goal was to play longer than the tournament was in Boise so you could actually have some of the basketball spotlight in this town on him. But it didn't happen. You mentioned the rough finish, sudden loss, a lot of frustration at the end of the year. I'm not saying the team was frustrated. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I wasn't out here talking to people at the team. But just from the fan base, you lose in the way you did in the conference tournament. That's not what you wanted.
So yesterday, Coach Rice appeared with Caves and Prater, talked about a lot of things. And the first order of business was comparing regular season success with postseason success.
The game of college basketball has changed so much in the fact that now it does seem like everything gets put into the postseason, and it's kind of a little backwards in that way, I think. I think a lot of people judge your season by completely how it ends. And, I think Virginia put things in perspective for me anyways when, they won the ACC by four games. They won the ACC tournament, and then they're the first team. They had this fabulous year, and then they're the first team in the history of the NCAA to lose a 16-1 game, and I just thought Tony handled it so well, and he kind of put it in perspective that way. That we were feeling the same kind of thing with maybe the way our season ended is that you put in all these great months of work and all these great games and good victories and mm-hmm. great moments, and then when it sometimes feels like it comes down to one game, it leaves a tough taste in your mouth, and it does it for the players, the coaches, and so as coaches, I think you can't let it go that way, especially with your guys, because, you are preaching that the league means something to win. And I think there has to be a balance there.
Thoughts, Chris? I think that he mentions Virginia, and Virginia had one of the greatest seasons in ACC history, as you mentioned, winning the league by four games, winning the conference tournament. But I think more people are going to remember Virginia 20 years from now as being the first team to lose to a 16 team in the tournament.
Yeah, and I find it interesting that he made that comparison and he brought up Tony Bennett in that way. And almost like the way Bennett handled that loss is about as well as a coach can handle a historic loss like that. And we'll get a little bit into, Coach Rice and how he maybe handled or didn't like or did like the question from Mike Prater come conference tournament when they lost. And he was not really trying to hear the slow growth question at the time, and clearly got a little bit upset with that at the time. And I think there's a difference between the loss that Boise State had to Utah State, because it was right at the end. You thought you could win it or were going to win it up until the very last minute of the game, when it's all of a sudden they hit that three and it's like, wow, Boise State's down by four and there's less than a minute to go. They could lose this game. Yeah, that was a problem. Virginia was down by 20 points. So, yeah, as a coach, I feel like it's a little bit easier to have Tony Bennett's perspective when you have the post-game interview. And we've brought this point up when there was a lot of time between the end of when you knew the result of the game and the actual interview. With Coach Rice, he didn't have as much time. So, like, while he's looking at Bennett and, like, kind of envying the way he handled it, I don't blame Coach Rice for being a little bit more emotional than Tony Bennett because, again, Coach Rice was a lot closer to when the game's result was. However, on that note, do you think Virginia would trade a regular season conference championship to not lose as a 1-16? I think they absolutely would. Yeah, and that's how college basketball is. You are – one of the quotes that Bennett had in that answer, it can't define you. And that's how you have to talk to your team about it. But you know at the time that it absolutely defines the season. You can't let that define you as a person. But from the perspective of how we treat March – if you're a one that loses to a 16, or if you're Boise State and you've lost as the better seed four straight years at the conference tournament, in a way that does matter.
All right, let me throw something out at you, and we'll just sort of play the hypothetical here. If you're Virginia, you lose to the 8-9 in the second round, or you get to go to the Sweet 16 and lose, but if you do that, you don't get your regular season. I'm taking the regular season in that case.
I think losing to 8-9 would still be bad. Like, that's still a bad loss for what they thought they would have.
But I'm not letting you get past the Sweet 16.
The Sweet 16 is when, okay, you start to be like, all right, stuff happens. Four seeds are good. Especially that four seed would have been what, Kentucky or Arizona?
It would have been either one, yeah. The 4-5, yes.
Like, that's at a certain point an understandable loss if you lost to Kentucky. But the 8-9, when you're in the position of Virginia, and they're another team that's had, you know, fantastic regular seasons before, but haven't had that Final Four push. If you could say, all right, we don't win the league this year, but we make it to the Final Four, at a certain point, I think Virginia takes that because they've had the success of regular seasons, and it's every time they've had it, it's been met with a disappointing loss. I think they were a one seed 2 years ago and lost to Syracuse on the doorstep of the Final Four, and that was considered a what in the world can you win with Tony Bennett in this system, and is this defensive oriented with a lack of pace on offense? Is that what we want to do? And it happened again. It's a 1-16 loss. It happens again next year. It's going to be bad again.
Coach Rice went on to talk about conference tournaments, discussion with that, because the WCC is changing their format to make it more difficult for the bottom seeds to get into the semifinals, easier for the top seeds, and this is what he had to say.
When we start looking at the way conference tournaments are set up and the NCAA tournament, I think we do have to look at that and maybe put more weight on a league championship and finishing high in league. And I think the WCC just went to that where they're going to give a double bye. We did that in the WAC 1 year. I came into the league. I talked these guys into, hey, give a double bye. And we ended up getting one and made it the championship game of that tournament. And so I do think you need to somehow weigh it a little bit better that you reward the people that win those games over the long grind. You know, it kind of irritates you as a coach to see some teams just, they go through the motions almost during the season, and then whack, they turn it on and play great in the tournament, win the tournament, and they're in the NCAA tournament, and hey, we had this great year. Well, what about the 5 months that led up to that? So,
let me just say a couple things about tournaments. If you're in a power conference, the tournament can only help your teams. If you're in a non-power five conference, the tournament has more of a chance to hurt your teams because you're probably not going to play your way in by getting to the conference championship if you were not good enough during the regular season, but you can play your way into the tournament if you're in a Power 5 team. Like if you're in the SEC and you knock off Florida and Kentucky and get to the championship game, and then let's say you lose to, I don't know, a really good Tennessee team for the championship, you probably can get yourself into the tournament. So I think when you're discussing conference tournaments, you've got to look at them separately, the big conferences versus the small conferences. I have always thought if you're in a bid that's maybe a one or a two bid league conference in the Mountain West, maybe kind of sits on the cusp of whether they're in this or whether they're not, and TV would never go for this. I've always thought you play your tournament. If you're one seed, your conference champ doesn't make it, you play another night with whoever wins the conference tournament against the one seed to go to the tournament.
So it's like double elimination.
Yes, for the champion.
Why do TV hate that?
Because they wouldn't know that there's a game.
Yeah,
so what are you going to do? You going to televise the Patriot League?
For 30 in the bag, just in case this doesn't happen. That's what they do. Like, that's what they do for playoff games.
Right.
Like, NBA playoff games, you game 5, 6, 7, they're if necessary.
But if you're at a site, you wouldn't have, you wouldn't know whether you were selling tickets. You wouldn't know. It would be very impractical. But I've always thought that you're somebody like a Vermont who had a huge regular season advantage over UMBC. Like a Loyola, who unfortunately would have been SOL if they had lost their conference championship to Illinois State. In a league, to me, those kinds of leagues, the conference tournament can only help the good, can only hurt the good teams in the league. And I think sometimes maybe they should weight the things a little bit differently to evaluate. That's why I always loved the Ivy League when they had no conference tournament. Now they only have four teams in the conference tournament. And the reason why I thought the Ivy League throughout the 80s and 90s had upsets in the conference tournament over more than other leagues, it's because their best team always went.
Hmm. Can we pick this up next?
Certainly can. Why not? Final Four Saturday coming up on Sports Radio The Ticket. Incredible run for Loyola. We'll continue at 4 with the Ramblers taking on Michigan, followed by Kansas and Villanova. The Final Four on Sports Radio The Ticket. National championship game Monday night as well, right here. Tip will be at 7:20 Mountain Time. If you can't watch it, listen right here on The Ticket. It's only halftime on our college basketball discussion. More of the highlights from Coach Rice yesterday with Caves and Prater. That's next on Sports Radio The Ticket. Second half of Coach Rice. Yesterday, again, he was on for a full half hour with Caves and Prater right after we finished at 3 o'clock. Want to hit some of the highlights. And Mike Prater was a little critical, I guess, towards the end of the season, thinking maybe Boise State hadn't quite reached what they needed to reach. Should we start right there, Chris?
Well, he says slow growth, and that's kind of what's set him off. I was just like, we were talking at the end about conference tournaments, and you know, he brought up the West Coast Conference as, you know, the potential changes that they would make, where, like, was it like almost a double bye or a triple
double bye, yes,
for the top two teams, where they both
did
play
that Coach
the semifinals.
Rice's, they did it Coach Rice's first year. Boise State did not play until the semifinals, and neither did Utah State, a team that won 30 games during the season.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, I was on record yesterday saying I hated the idea of the West Coast Conference making those changes and having a tournament where it starts at the semifinals for the top two teams and it looks like a set of stairs, the tournament bracket. I don't know. To me, like, I think the conference tournament, like, while it is not, like, maybe just is the right way to put it, because it doesn't reward necessarily the best teams, the NCAA tournament is the same way. It is not just. If you're starting to make college basketball into what college football is, where, all right, let's only put the top two or the top four in there, now you're changing the fundamental part about the sport. Like, I understand it from the coach's perspective, too, because he's like, yo, this season is November, December, January, February, March. Like, there's five. But, like, there is something to be said in the fabric of college basketball where March does matter a lot. And I followed, and, you know, I'm the play-by-play announcer for the Boise State women's basketball team. And you could almost say that they've been the opposite of the men's team lately, where, you know, they haven't been top two in the conference other than last year, where they won it, or this year, whatever you want to say.
Whatever year just completed.
Where they didn't win the regular season and ended up winning the conference tournament. But the other years, again, they've won three of the last four conference tournaments. There were four seeds en route to going out and winning the championship. But I do think there's something to be said for, you know what the set is, so you need to get your team in a way to where they're clicking at the end of the year, and they make that run in the conference tournament. And Coach Gordy Presnell does a very good job of getting his team to kind of click at that moment, and maybe he would just say it's sheer coincidence. But, like, the fact is, the women's team has found a way three of the past 4 years, knowing the circumstance of March and its single elimination and the structure of the tournament, to be able to make that run. And it's special when they do it. And to see them win the three games in, I guess the women's tournament's a little bit different of a structure with the way the games are spread out, but to win three games over a short amount of time to get it done like that and the structure of it, I think that is part of college basketball, where in the conference tournament, I think you need to at least win three games to win your tournament and not just two. That's just where I sit on it. And it's different than Coach Rice. And I understand why Coach Rice has the opinion that he has. It's just my perspective of seeing, you know, the Boise State women's basketball team and what they have done. Like, I have a different perspective.
I think I sit somewhere between both of you. I think you need to, especially as I said, in the conferences that aren't the Power Six, I think you need to reward the regular season more than just giving you the top seed in the tournament. But I think giving somebody a bye into the semifinals is too much of a head start. And maybe, who knows, what happens if somebody sits and somebody gets on a roll and gets beat? One of those teams coming into the semifinals, well, then somebody else might turn around and argue, wow, they had to rest too much. The other team was in a groove and got things going. And,
that's
and
the Boise State argument. Like, they keep having to play teams that played the first day, and it's hurt them because, like, they have an adjustment period, and the teams that come in the day before aren't familiar with the rims. Now, I don't know if that excuse that, works with Utah State.
Well, not in that game. It might have worked with the week the year before, but they were behind. So,
is there a true right way? I don't know. But there's part of it that, like, all right, some dude missed like a good chunk of the year with an injury, but he's back. Or, you know, a team had some conflict within a year and they overcame that conflict right in time for the conference tournament. And I do think that's part of college basketball to have that avenue. Now, maybe it's like, you know, you should punish teams that finish at the bottom more and make it significantly more difficult than the teams at the top. But then again, they do reward the champ by giving them an NIT berth. The NIT is a thing. Like, you get additional basketball if you win the league and you don't win your conference tournament, you do get the NIT. Which there's postseason hoops.
And I think here's the thing. Generally speaking, a team in the bottom half of the league is not going to have enough to come through and win the tournament. They're going to knock somebody out. But usually speaking, Utah State did not get to the championship game. It was San Diego State and it was New Mexico that got to the championship game. Both of those teams were in the top half of the league. So you basically knock some teams out, but usually the bottom feeders usually don't proceed and go all the way to the championship game. At least I don't believe there was any this year in college basketball. Most of the chalk ended up winning the bottom half of the teams. So Mike Prater's question now talks about more or less the state of the program yesterday with Coach Rice.
Now that you've had a few weeks to decompress your season, kind of take a look at your season and what were your thoughts about it. We heard you after Vegas. We heard you after the NIT loss. And there was a lot of good, and I know it was a disappointing finish, but your thoughts on the season now that you've had a chance to reflect and think about it?
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank you for your questions right after the tournament. And
I'm here to help.
I'm being
serious. I hear them every day, man. Don't be thanking them for that.
There's a there's a divine connection sometimes of people that are put into your life, and sometimes those kind of people motivate you a little bit. And I want this program to achieve great things, and I want, I took this job because I think the sky's the limit in a place like this, and so I get a little defensive sometimes, and, I came at you about that. It's not where I want it to be. I mean, we're 8 years in. I'm really, really happy with the progress we've made over these 8 years, and we've kept getting better, and the crowds keep getting better, and it's, we're putting a good product out there, but I'm not, it keeps me up at night that we're not making a big run in this tournament. We had a good team and we did some great things. And I know it's a fine line. I know that's just basketball, but I want that for our fans. I want it for, the city and the state. And I want it most of all for my players who work so hard and they're right there. And so it is, it's a fine line between being able to make that run what Loyola's making and, you're out in the conference tournament. And so it's one of those deals where I feel like you just got to keep plugging away and you got to keep making it better. And, our administration has to fight to make it better. And that's what I told Kurt. I said, you know what? Coaches, we can win games. We can scheme and we can put together a team and we can go win some games. But administration wins championships and wins and has a consistent program. We've seen that in our football program. And that's why I came here, because they know how to build a winner. And that's what I want to do in basketball, where we have a program that just keeps rolling, keeps getting better. I know we're not going to get exactly where all of us want to be overnight, but you just keep plugging away, knocking on the door. All those years at Gonzaga I had, we were knocking on the door, Sweet 16, Elite 8, Sweet 16, Sweet 16, and then Mark broke through to the Final Four championship game, and now he's had four Sweet 16s in a row. But that, that's what I want to create here is a program that can knock on the door, and then we're going to break it down.
Coach, one of the ways to get there.
And again, that's yesterday, Caves and Prater with Coach Rice.
Yeah, that was a very well thought out and lengthy answer that basically is a fan of Boise State basketball. That was pretty much everything you wanted to hear. Like, that was, I thought, like a bullseye type answer that made you as a fan excited and know that, hey, first of all, he's not accepting the result as like, this is the ceiling or this is what we are. And like, there is something to still strive for. And I also thought like the way he was like, I thank you for that question. It was just cool as a listener, because just knowing how it sounded on the press conference at the time in March when they, you know, just after the loss, to have him come in and have Coach Rice and Mike Prater kind of joke about that and kind of understand each other's perspective. I just thought that was good as a consumer of Boise State basketball to just hear those two kind of laugh it out a little bit. But, like, everything I wanted to hear from, like, you know, it keeps me up at night. I need to figure out how to do it. And then the note of administrations win championships. Coaches can win some games along the line, but administration wins championships. That was kind of an eyebrow raiser. Like, that's certainly something that caught your attention when he said it.
I think to me, the way I took that comment is you end up with, you need funds, you need facilities. You can't do it, you know, with a bag of balls and just some sneakers. Mm-hmm. So I think he's absolutely right. I think everything that goes into the program helps. And I'll even go further. It's not just the administration. It's not just the school, but it's the fan base. It's the people who buy tickets to come to the games. If you're getting better crowds, you've got more money to work with. If you're drawing better, you might be able to attract, you know, a better caliber of non-conference opponent to come in if you have a little more money to work with in the kitty to pay somebody to come. So I think it's everything that carries you over the top. I think that to think that you can, you know, like, I'll give you a great example. San Jose State.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is a losing hand. I think that is a losing hand from yesterday, from today, and from tomorrow. I will be shocked if San Jose State ever finds their way into the middle of the Mountain West.
No doubt. But don't you think it was somewhat noteworthy for him to say that out loud over the radio? Like, administration?
No.
Like, I thought that was pretty...
I think it's honest.
Yeah, it was honest. It was, you don't always get honesty, though.
No, you don't.
From coaches.
No.
In those type of settings. And I thought that was a very honest, blunt way to put it. And he's kind of saying, I need help. Like,
yeah.
That's kind of what he was saying. I need help. Like, I'm doing what I can do, but I need help. And I don't hear coaches say that all the time, especially in his position on the radio like that.
Well, and then Boise is a good spot as well. He did say that.
Yeah.
He's had good support. We've got good facilities. We've got good, you know, school in which you can attract people to come. So he's done a good job of it, but it's not one thing. And unfortunately, when you lose in the conference tournament, it is one thing.
Yeah.
It might be one missed shot. Talked about scheduling, and that was something that came up with the WCC. Let's see if we can just squeeze that one in quickly before we have to get to break.
We've gotten the only two at-large bursts in the school history. We were on the bubble. I think what knocked us off was, you know, that's where they give you no margin for error. You know, like all the BCS schools, they just have wins and losses really don't matter because they just have all those. They have so much more margin for error because every night they're playing a quadrant one team. So it doesn't matter.
Okay.
So if we go to Utah State, which you take half the teams in the NCAA tournament and make them go play at Utah State, they probably lose.
Mm-hmm.
It's a hard place to play, and historically it's tough. And you can't – it's tough to go out and be perfect on the road, especially in the Mountain West. I mean, night in, night out, you know, and we lost one game at Wyoming where the ball went in and out at the buzzer. And then we lost in overtime, and then we lose a close one at Utah State. And that probably knocked us out.
Okay.
Had we won those two, we'd have been in really good shape.
Hmm.
And that's what the feedback I was getting.
Okay.
And I got that from the Mountain West people. Because you look at, you know, we knew that Loyola Chicago was going to be a quadrant one win. Oregon became a quadrant one win. So we were 2-2 in quadrant one, and we were really good in quadrant two. So we were in a lot better shape than people thought. But losing those two games put us where we had to win the conference tournament.
It also might have been shared with Nevada if you won those two games. I mean, everybody can point to a couple close games that could go either way, and that's why I think it's tough when you're in a conference. The other thing, looking to next year, we really don't know what the non-conference schedule is, but last year they had a three-game tournament down at Myrtle Beach. You go 2-1. I think if you go to those tournaments, you have to expect that you're not going to win it. I mean, it's just hard. You can win it, but you want to go 2-1 against good competition. And then you end up with a home game in the Missouri Valley Challenge. That was with Loyola. You ended up winning that one. Ended up by the season's finish being a great win. Next year, you'll have to go on the road for that one. So that'll be a little bit more difficult, assuming the team is the same caliber. You may not get somebody as good as Loyola. And then the two big games on the road were Oregon and SMU. I don't know what they've scheduled as far as non-conference, but I think you'd like to play in the big tournament and then have two or three games against high-caliber non-conference teams. I don't know whether they have that on the schedule, but you'd like to get one of the mature places where hopefully you can win that game.
You also got to get lucky with those. Like, you don't know how good those teams are going to be in those preseason tournaments. Like, Iowa State typically having that in your, you know, in your bag for a non-conference game would be awesome. Iowa State, the previous 4 or 5 years, were really good. They weren't this year. They were terrible. They're the last place team in the Big 12. At least I believe they were.
They were down at the bottom.
Yeah, and like, what can you do about that? You get into an event, you have a Big 12 team in it, a Big 12 team that is, what, finished, I think it was top two in the conference.
But you lost the game to them, and that was one of the ones, but Chandler was hurt.
Yeah, Chandler was hurt, which is unlucky, but that could be a different tier game that you've played if Iowa State is better. Mm-hmm. And
but that's the luck of the draw every year. I mean, you end up getting Loyola of Chicago. And that could have been, you could have had Indiana State that finished towards the middle to the bottom of the league.
So you got the good positive end with Loyola Chicago.
$1,000, that's like 106 packs. You're shot at $1,000 four times every weekday, 7 a.m., 10 a.m., 1 p.m., and 4 p.m. All you have to do is text the keyword to win. Remember, please don't text and drive. 4K a day will start tomorrow at 7 a.m. on Sports Radio The Ticket. Coming up next in the update, what Bronco coach was once again awarded for his team's dominating performance this year. That's next on Sports Radio The Ticket.
Ticket Sports Update, sponsored by Stormore Sheds. Create a space of your own with a new shed shop or garage from Idaho's best-selling shop for over 25 years. See why you're for yourself at Stormore Sheds in Meridian. Well, Boise State swim and diving coach Jeremy Kipp has been named the Mountain West Swim and Diving Coach of the Year for the third consecutive season. Just the third coach in conference history to win the award 3 years in a row.
I think that's impressive because I think a lot of times when it looks like you've got the team that's got it rolling, coaches are looking for somebody else that maybe comes in second or third in the league and maybe they'll spread the wealth. So congratulations to Coach Kipp. To me, that's impressive.
Man, maybe he does like brings nice stuff to the meetings when all the coaches come together or something. Because you're right, usually they just get sick of giving the same person the award. But maybe he provides nice gifts in the meetings. Good donuts.
But it also helps. I mean, he's got a deep program. They win the conference championship. They do well when they go on to the national. He's done a terrific job at Boise State for swimming and diving.
Well, the NFL draft is a month away, and it's time for all the coaches of top quarterback prospects make the rounds, vouch for their guy to be the number one draft pick, except for former UCLA head coach Jim Mora Jr. Mora was on the NFL Network, and he was asked who the Browns should take at number one, and Mora did not endorse his former quarterback, Josh Rosen.
I'll tell you this, because of fit, I would take Sam Darnold if I were the Cleveland Browns. You know, I think that that blue-collar, gritty, attitude. I think his teammates will love him. I think the city will love him. He'll say the right things. He'll come in and he'll represent well. I think he kind of represents what Cleveland is. And then if I was one of the New York teams, I'd take Josh like that. I think they're both going to be great pros.
I think he's probably answering very honestly, but I'd like to know what his answer would have been if he had still been the Bruins coach.
Yeah, well, here's where I sit on this. When you're the head coach of the guy and you're making money because he's playing well for you, like that's what happens in college basketball, college football, the coach is making money, the player isn't supposed to be making money. And I feel like as a coach, you have a responsibility, even if you don't believe it, you have a responsibility of just hyping your guy up and saying he should be the first quarterback taken. Like Brian Kelly last year with, who was the quarterback?
Deshaun Kizer.
Deshaun Kizer, yeah. He said that he's not pro ready and he should have came back. I feel like that is almost insulting for a coach and against what you're there for. Like you've already profited off of him plenty. The least you can do is say nice things about the guy when he's entering the draft process and about to get money for himself. Now, Jim Mora is in a different boat. Because he's no longer the UCLA coach. And I believe he is an analyst, right? So he's being paid by the NFL Network to analyze. So it is a different responsibility for him So I am not as critical for Jim Mora on this as I would be for if he was still the coach or if this was Brian Kelly.
But he did say that he thought his guy was a first-round guy and would be suited for either New York team, which picking what, a couple picks beyond the Browns. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like he trashed his own guy. But I think that – I think you owe it to your guy – to try to help him as much as possible with, you know, if somebody comes and asks you a question, you don't want to lie, but I think you want to try to help your guy get placed in the NFL as best as possible.
And he might be right. Like, you know, the blue collar, I don't know why Cleveland needs a blue collar quarterback. To me, they need a good one. I don't care what color the collar is. I just want it to be good if I'm Cleveland. But if he needs to be blue collar and that's not Rosen, Rosen's gone on record and saying, I don't want to get drafted as high as possible just so I can say I got drafted as high as possible. I want to go to a team that fits me, is what he is on the record of saying.
So, well, maybe Mora's helping him out there
exactly.
By saying, oh, Cleveland, you might not want to take him. He doesn't really. Coach, I don't want to go to Cleveland. I'd rather play in New York.
Nothing screams blue collar like Southern California. Somehow.
Well, both quarterbacks are talking about it from Southern
California. If you're going to say blue collar, I think your answer would have to be Josh Allen. He's the closest to blue collar.
Well, he also came from a community college and worked his way up through the ranks. I mean, if that's your definition. Yeah. I mean, all depends on what your definition is.
I think as Chris said, it doesn't matter on their collar. It depends if they're good.
I think Brett Rypien's more blue collar. Draft Brett Rypien next year.
I mean,
right? Like, Josh Allen was all hype.
They might need to.
Allen was all hype this year. All hype, all these magazine features. He won the offseason last year, and he's winning it this year, while Brett Rypien's out here with his head down and doing work. So next year when the draft comes around, draft Brett Rypien. If you're looking for blue collar.
With their history of quarterbacks, they might need a quarterback. Well, we'll end the sports update. Bob Saber Day, it's just one day away. That's the opening day of baseball, and you usually use spring training to make sure you have any messes cleaned up in your organization, everything sorted out. Well, the LA Dodgers, very grateful opening day wasn't last night. That's because their game against the Angels called after five innings after a sewer line in the stadium backed up and some of the excess waste, we'll call it, started to drain onto the field.
I hope that's a precursor of things to come for the Dodger organization. An omen, if you will, that things are going to back up when they're not expecting it and sewage is going to flow all out. I hope that's the story of 2018 for the LA Dodgers.
I'm just not going to talk anymore. After that comment, just go ahead, Bob. Finish out this segment.
Friday morning at 9, you can get $50 worth of gift certificates for $25 to the Tortilla Factory Mexican Grill. It's home of Boise's only tortilla machine, guaranteeing you the freshest tortillas and Mexican food in the Treasure Valley. Friday morning at 9, get ready. Go to KTIK.com and click on Sweet Deals. Coming up next in Quick Hits, the NFL has some new rules for 2018. We will take four of them and debate them. That's coming up next on Idaho Sports Talk on Sports Radio, The Ticket.
Quick Hits with Bob and Chris. Topic number one.
Well, the NFL league meetings are wrapping up, and there are several rule changes that went into effect, four of them, which we thought was a perfect idea for Quick Hits. So we'll go with the first rule change, the one that Bob Beeler championed right after the game ended between the Saints and Vikings, finally been put into effect. The team scores the winning touchdown at the end of regulation, and there's zeros on the clock. That team will no longer be allowed or required to kick the extra point or two-point conversion, which just results in a knee. The game is automatically over.
And a great move, because why bring people out of the locker room that are disappointed? I think you're just asking for some cheap shots. Who cares about the spread? Sorry if that makes a difference in somebody winning or losing. That's the breaks. Applaud the NFL. Should have done this long ago.
Well, they're going to knee on the ball anyway, so it doesn't affect the spread.
Like, no, it wouldn't.
That's the thing. They're not kicking the extra point, and they're not kicking it because now you can give 2 points the other way. So in theory, you could still lose the game if, you know, you decide to run a play, which in a way makes it seem like you should keep this rule on the book because it is a potential for the defense to score 2 points. And in a way, that is their chance to come back and win. If you score a touchdown to go up by one, shouldn't in theory you have to play out the last play because the other team, if you fumble the snap, they could pick it up and run it back?
Right? You're going to take it.
Are you going to get rid of the kneel down then?
Yeah, why not?
You want to get rid of the kneel down at the
in
end?
The regular, at the end of the regulation?
Yeah.
No,
like,
you're not. No, you're going to see people. I don't know. Come on. You've won the game.
It's very irrelevant. It's like not going to play. But my whole thing is, if we're going to do this, then the next thing you're going to do is eliminate the kneel down. You're just going to say, all right, they have no timeouts, under 2 minutes left, they're winning, the game's over. You don't even have to do the kneel downs, which maybe that's fine. Maybe that's, again, it's irrelevant because it's not changing the result of a game or not.
Topic number two.
So the late breaking rule, everyone's starting to have a problem with, at least NFL players. It was made official that if you hit helmet to helmet or lower your helmet, so basically crown of the helmet, sort of like targeting in the NCAA, that is an automatic 15-yard penalty. However, they have not ruled if there'll be an automatic ejection like college, but for at least for now, if you hit him with the crown of the helmet, automatic 15-yard penalty.
Well, there'll be a lot of those because it's going to take, it takes a lot to get out of the habit of just leading with your helmet and doing it. I think that they want to make the game safer, or at least they want to make the appearance of the game safer for sure, and I think this is something that's going to have a lot of consternation. If that rule stays for this coming year, I think that's going to be more controversial than the catch rule.
Yeah, this has a potential to change football forever, and I think it has more of a chance of not even being called. Like, that's the thing about this, is that if they really want to stick to this definition, this is going to change football. Like, it absolutely will. If you get a 15-yard penalty for just lowering the head, getting ready for a hit, that is going to draft. You'll see that like five times a game. Mm-hmm. It'll change the game forever if they want to call it, if that's what they really want. But I just have a feeling it'll be more of the college basketball rule emphasis things where, all right, they call it the first exhibition and maybe the first two games when you're playing all these schools that, you know, doesn't matter as much. And then when all of a sudden when you get in the conference play, we forgot what the rule emphasis were.
Number three.
Well, talking about ejections, the NFL did pass one rule regarding that. It was allowed. There's going to be a replay official in New York that will be watching the games, and that will give that official the ability to eject any player who has a non-football act. So think Gronk diving on the Bills player, Mike Evans sucker punching the Saints player, anything like that. A official in New York can basically contact the officials at the game and say, you know what, that was a legal play. Get him out of there. So it's no longer just on the officials on the field to eject someone for a non-football foul.
I think I'm okay with that because sometimes they see it, sometimes they don't. If it's that bad, I would hope that if you're doing it, the level of egregiousness is pretty high to eliminate somebody. But if it is something that's really egregious that they would have ejected somebody for if the officials saw it, I don't have a problem with that.
Yeah, using the replays and stuff that, you know, we can see, and the officials, they still have limited view of the field. Now, my question is, like, how long will the – like, what is it in the legal term? Like, where after a certain point you can't be charged with a crime anymore? What is that called? It's a legal term.
Yeah, right? I know
it's
what you're talking
about. It's been a while since I even had a class that related to law.
Statute whatsoever. Of limitations.
Yeah, there we go. How long's the statute of limitations?
Like within a quarter? Or?
Yeah, like if you go back, oh, wow, we missed that. And on the replay, on social media, it's blowing up. Like, that's sometimes what happens. Right? Like, you miss it on the replay. Even the broadcasters miss it, but someone on social media picks it up, and now it's getting all these retweets. And if it happened in the first quarter, and now it's the third quarter, can you eject them?
The whole emphasis of this rule, basically, because Gronk and Mike Evans got suspended for a game, so they want to eject these guys so they don't have to suspend them later. That's the whole emphasis of the rule. So
it's going to be – the punishment is going to be adjudicated in the game that you actually did it.
Yeah.
But, the question still remains – How long is the statute of limitations? If it's the first quarter and we didn't realize you did it until halftime, if you're suspended for the second half, is that a sufficient punishment? Like, I don't know how far back in time we're going to go. And if, you know, Gronk was able to catch two touchdowns in the second quarter, wouldn't you be upset if you're the team that he caught two touchdowns against?
Yeah, so you're going to have people like golf watching for rule violations.
You know what? That is so true. This is going to become, oh my goodness, you are right. People are going to be at home looking for this. As soon as they see something, they're going to get out here on social media and tweet at, like, Field Yates and at, Tiki Barber and all the football people who tweet on Sundays so they can retweet it. And then maybe it gets enough traction for New York. Oh no, you're right, Fish. You called this ahead of time. It's going to be the worst thing ever.
Number four.
And finally, the big one. We all knew this was coming, and it passed a couple days ago, 32-0. There's a new rule for how we're going to define a catch. Number one, you have to control the ball. Number two, you need 2 feet or another body part down inside the boundaries. And then number three, you need to make a football move, such as a third step, reaching for the goal line or first down, or the ability to perform such acts. The big thing is it's going to de-emphasize going to the ground with control of the ball as long as you've made a football move first.
I think this will be a boon to the offenses on either side. I think that'll help. There'll be more catches because of this, and I don't know, probably simplifies it a little bit, which might be the best thing that they could do, simplify what is a catch.
Yeah, but what is control? Well, you still have these broad terms that we still haven't defined. Control of the ball. How am I supposed to know what control technically is? A football move, such as you list three things. Is that the only three things? Is there more things that can constitute a football move? I still see some problems with the way the rule is written and how it's going to be misinterpreted on broadcast.
Opening day is tomorrow. Chris and I go on record with our picks for the baseball season. Why is this year, at least in my opinion, the easiest year to pick division winners? That's next on Sports Radio The Ticket. Love tomorrow. My books, it's the first day of spring. One thing when I was looking to take the job at Boise State, Chris, and I had, you know, you have your column, reasons to take the job, reasons not to take the job. I had one thing that was on the no side. Not close to Major League Baseball was the only thing I had the no side to basically stay at UMass. Everything else was on the positive side for taking this job.
And you took this job
and
anyway?
And I took this job anyway.
Wow.
I would go to an opening day game at least one a year every time I was in the East, and sometimes I would go to two. Not on the same day, but if the Orioles
if you
say
could,
open.
You would.
Well, if I could, I would, yes. Go to the Yankees and Mets usually don't open on the same day, but go to the Yankees at one and the Mets at, say, seven if they had a night game. But to me, I just love the pomp and circumstance. Usually get to see the aces of both teams pitch. Even if your team is not supposed to do that well, you're tied for first place. You're hoping for good weather. I love opening day. I've gone a couple of times down to the Bay Area for the Giants opener since I've been here, but sometimes a Thursday isn't as conducive as if it's a Friday, or you're probably not going to get lucky with a Saturday or Sunday. But to me, tomorrow is just, to me, the day that I love and wish I could be at one of the parks.
I mean, if you really wanted to, Fish and I, we can handle it tomorrow.
You could. I don't want to see the Dodgers raise a National League championship pennant. Although the only thing worse than that would be to see them raise a World Series championship pennant. If they had opened in Arizona, I probably would have gone. They'd opened in Denver, or I might have hesitated with Denver just because I'd be afraid that maybe I went to Denver one other time in May and it got rained out. So I would be a little bit hesitant, but if they were in a different spot, went one year when I was in Massachusetts, flew down to Houston, saw them open up at Minute Maid Park. Weather was fantastic in Houston. Also went one year when I was here down to Phoenix. Weather was perfect in Phoenix opening season. I've been to Phoenix in July for a Giants game. No, I don't want to go again. I'll go to the Giants when they play in Arizona.
There's
in
a reason
April.
Spring training is in Arizona.
Yeah. But it just, to me, I don't know, there's just something about it. You know, you go to game one, and then in a lot of parks, you go to game two, and there's about a third of the crowd of what there was on game one.
You start 0-2, and the season is over. Isn't that the old joke for the Mets? First pitch. Okay, season is over. Yeah, it's a great day, except it's not today. It's tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
Does it take away from you the fact that it is a Thursday? Like, it's awkward for me. It's in March. It's on a Thursday instead of it being on a Monday in April, the day of the championship game of the NCAA.
Well, I think they did it. I don't know. I never saw this written, but I think maybe they did it to go away from the championship game. The year I went to the game in Houston, I did not see the NCAA championship game that year because I was at the Giants-Astros, was on at the exact same time as the championship game was. I think maybe they wanted to go away from it. And by going Thursday, you're opening Easter falls early this year, so you got Easter weekend.
Yeah,
so maybe you want to go on Thursday. So I don't know. That's just a guess. But I feel this year, looking at the teams, based on the way everybody's coming out of spring training, the teams that won last year, what the teams have back, I didn't hesitate on pulling the trigger on any team to win a division. I think this is the easiest year to call. Somebody's not going to win because they'll have injuries. But at least right now, there's not a lot of debate. There was only one that I hesitated for a second before picking the team in one division. There was only one division that I hesitated at all.
Go to Vegas. Parlay it. Do it. Like you said, one, they won't all win the division. No, have confidence in your conviction. If you think these teams, and you say, and for me, I agree. I wrote down the standings are as predictable this year as ever, like, as least that I can remember, where there is a clear-cut team that you think is going to win the division. So, like, if you wanted to bet on a team that could win the division, you're probably not going to get the greatest odds of it. The only way you could maybe, you know, get significant value out of it is to parlay a few of these together, and, you know, they all have to come through. But if you think they're all going to come through, then that's what you would do.
Last year, the winners in the National League were the Nationals, the Cubs, and the Dodgers going east to west. Both of us think those three teams are going to win their divisions once again. In the American League, I've made one switch. I have the Yankees winning the East instead of the Red Sox, and that was the only division that I thought for a moment where I wanted to go. I've got the Indians and Astros repeating, and I notice you have the same three East to West in the American League as well.
Yeah, I can't. What's your case for another team? Like, that's the thing. And Fish, maybe you have a different perspective on this, but like, what is your case to argue a different team other than those?
I guess my also question would be, and if you are going to argue another team, who are you going to argue?
Yeah.
No, I mean, this, you guys, it's chalk. I can't see anything, unless Bob's going to say he could argue the Red Sox and the Yankees are going to be flip-flop.
That's the only one that I think I could argue. Is if you took the Yankees or you took the Red Sox, you could argue the other one. But aside from that, do you really think the Nats are going to be beaten? The Cubs, the Dodgers, pains me to say that, the Indians and the Astros. I mean, which one do you think is the most vulnerable of those five?
Nationals, more vulnerable than anybody else, just because if they have a slow start, it's going to be a circus because of Harper. Mm-hmm. Like, that's over 162 games. We have 162 games. Not many surprises happen unless you get injuries over 162 games. And they're the only ones where I think the season's cut in half. It's not 162 games. It's closer to 70, because if they get off to a bad start in their first 70, they're not going to have the patience to be able to break out of it.
New manager. You fired the previous manager because he can't get you to the World Series. Your best player, maybe the best player in baseball, is a free agent at the end of the year. So a lot probably depends on how things go. I agree with you. They might be the team that would have the best chance, but I don't know with the pitching they have and some of the other guys they have. I don't know. Your Phillies might be the only team that has a chance to run them down. I think the Braves, the Mets, and unfortunately, Fish is Fish. I don't think even if the Nationals stumble, some have a chance. Now, we get to the wild card, and I think this is going to be where it's going to be interesting, because I can make a case for a lot of teams to be able to slip in there for the wild card, which gets you into that one-game playoff, which gets you into the postseason, and then maybe if lightning in a bottle strikes, you can end up winning the World Series. We have some teams that are the same in the American League, the Red Sox, which I think, again, we talked about how they could either win the division or get the wild card. But every other pick we have, both National League teams and the second American League wild card, Chris, are different.
Yeah, I think that this is a year for the Phillies. I think they could do it. I mean, it wouldn't be like a train wreck if they didn't make the wild card, but you know, Gabe Kapler leading the way, first year, energetic, maybe a little overly energetic. We'll see what the line is when he actually has to manage through a 162-game season. But, you know, adding Arrieta to a pitching rotation in a division that has three bad teams in it, you're going to pile up some wins if you are able to take care of business. Aaron Nola is a very talented young pitcher, too, that they have, a guy out of LSU who's pitched pretty well in his time in the big league so far. You know, Santana is now on the team, and he's expected to play a role. And Rhys Hoskins is a guy who was on fire at the end of last year. Like, they have some players. I think they can be one of the wild cards. And I'm kind of going chalk with the other one. It's always safe to go to Cardinals.
They're not going to be bad.
Yeah, exactly. Like, don't be the hunt. Like, I won't look tragically wrong by picking the Cardinals.
And I've taken for my two National League teams the Brewers, who I think have been one of the few teams that said, let's go, let's spend some money, let's add some people. They were close last year to making the playoffs. And I think the Rockies are going to end up getting the other wild card. I would have loved to have penciled Giants in there as a wild card, but with the status of the pitching staff, Madison Bumgarner to begin the season, not nearly as confident, so I like them. And on the American League side, you've got the Twins, who made the second wild card last year, and I took the Angels. I think they've added enough people, and maybe I'm one of the few that thinks Ohtani is going to be able to pitch for them in this season and help them get to the wild card.
Yeah, Twins are a safe pick. Again, a new manager. I got to kind of have to figure that out. But, you know, they didn't lose much. Solid team. They're not going to have much hype around them. Another one where I think there's bad teams in the division, and that's always the key for me with the wild card. Is there, like, some just teams where you can just pile up some wins against? I think it's that way in the AL.
Because it is an unbalanced schedule. Yeah. You get more games against the teams in your division. So if you got bad teams, mm-hmm. which may work against the Rockies, because I do think that if the Giants are maybe the third or the fourth best team, they and the Diamondbacks have been competitive, where maybe some of the other teams at third and fourth may not be as competitive. All right, now, a thing I always like looking at is the over-under, with 81 being flat out 500 ball. So if somebody is labeled as 81 wins, that means you've got to make the call whether they're going to win more or lose more. But some of the numbers go north of 81, some go south. Because I have the Rockies making the playoffs, the Rockies are projected to win 82 by the folks in the desert. I have the Rockies winning more than that. I have the Brewers winning more than the 84.5 that they have. Then I always like to look at somebody that really has a low win total. And that's usually around a team that you think might lose 100 games. They have the White Sox winning 68. I think they're going to be north of that. Hmm. And then the Mariners are listed at 81.5.
They're always a swing team.
And I have them pegged as under 500 this year.
You didn't like them last year either.
I didn't like them last year either.
Yeah, and a lot of people were picking them last year, and you're like, eh, no,
I don't like them again. So I'll go under with the Mariners. Those are my four over-under choices.
Mariners are almost like the kings of the offseason. You look at their roster and you're like, well, they should be good. And then they get off to a slow start and it's hard for them to flip. They'll have that good streak, though, within the year where it's like, all right, this is what it looks like when it all clicks.
Every team has one of those good streaks.
I guess so. 162 games long. But I feel like the Mariners streaks are a little bit more pronounced than a lot of teams. I didn't write down the Phillies. I should put the Phillies as an over. I don't have their over-under, but I think it's in the 70s.
I think it was like 78.
Yeah, so if I think they're going to make the playoffs, put that over. The Brewers spent money. I don't think that's a tough division. Like, for them to hit the over of 84.5 beasts, like a slam dunk over 500 team, you have them as one of your overs that you like. I have them as an under, because if the Cardinals are the Cardinals and the Cubs rack up the wins that we think they are going to be, are going to have, it's going to have to be like a couple of years ago when the NL Central was just like stacked, when they have like three teams with close to 90 wins. Like, I don't think that's going to happen. So I have the Brewers as an under. Rays over has been like the best bet ever. Like, throughout the last 10 years, the Rays over bet has just been money. And now, you know, Joe Maddon was a big part of it.
I think if you asked me, not that I had him on my list, but if you said go one way or the other, I would go under.
That always seems to make sense because you look at the talent, but then they figure it out somehow, some way, they're better than we think. Like, Rays over has been one of the best bets. And I think, Fish, this is my lock.
You're kicking me while I'm down, man.
This is my lock of, if I have one, if there's such thing as one. The Marlins over-under is 64.5. The Miami Marlins, Fish, your squad.
I mean,
this team is going to lose 100 games.
I mean, I would take the under 100%, like, but you don't need to kick me while I'm down.
Yeah, how is this team, like, the over-under, like, is them losing, what, 98, roughly, 97, 98. That is a 100-loss baseball team if I've ever seen one. I'm absolutely going under with the Marlins. And, Fish, why are you even still a Marlins fan? You have given up the Marlins. You've sat on this show. You've given up. Yeah, every day you come in still wearing a Marlins hat.
It's a comfy hat. I mean, they're the first game on ESPN. They could start 1-0 tomorrow. I will know by the time the show
starts. You're not abandoning them.
Who are they playing in the opener tomorrow?
They play the Cubs.
Oh.
You're too loyal.
Are they home? They're home, aren't they?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, they might.
You're a guy like, I'm breaking up with her every day. And then come next year, still there.
I'll root with you tomorrow. I'll root with you tomorrow.
Well, if they start 0-10, Chris, I'll have a new hat, which is entirely possible.
Final Four Saturday coming up on Sports Radio The Ticket. Loyola will take on Michigan at 4, followed by Kansas and Villanova right after. Final Four on Sports Radio The Ticket, plus the national championship game Monday at 7:20. If you can't watch, listen to The Ticket. You heard our team picks. What about some of the individual awards? That's next on Sports Radio The Ticket. As easy as I thought it was to pick the division winners in 2018, picking MVP Cy Young, Manager of the Year, and Home Run Leader, that's difficult this time of the year. Because if anybody goes on the disabled list for any length of time, they're probably not going to be the MVP, the Cy Young, or the Home Run Leader. So you got to pick somebody that you think is going to be healthy. That being said, you also need to pick somebody that you think's team is going to be good. And we have four different choices for MVP. You pick two, and I pick two, giving us four. I think Houston's going to be really good. I think Houston in the regular season is going to be better than they were last year, adding Verlander for the whole season and Garrett Cole from the Pirates in the rotation. I think their pitching is going to be significantly better. But I have their all-around player, shortstop Carlos Correa, winning the American League MVP. And I think the Nationals are going to have a big year in a walk year for Bryce Harper. I think he's going to be your National League MVP.
Bryce Harper, slow starter last year. Remember we were talking around the All-Star break on just like, what in the world's going on with that dude? He's just not producing in the way you thought he would. So that just made me a little hesitant. Like, I just don't know how, you know, he'll handle this whole thing. He's a wild card for sure. Correa is, of course, a nice, safe pick. You pick a guy on a good team. Baseball is just one of those sports, so you don't need to be on a great team to be MVP. I don't have
because numbers matter.
Yeah, I don't have this team in the playoffs, but I'm picking the best player in baseball. That's Mike Trout. Mike Trout was healthy last year. He's the MVP, and I don't care what anybody else did. His numbers were incredible. I saw like a stat a week ago that was like he still hadn't struck out in spring training. Like, he just makes contact. He rips the ball all over the place. Gap shots, home runs. He has speed on the bases. There's nothing he's not good at. So Mike Trout's the most valuable individual baseball player. If he's healthy, he wins the award. I have Chris Bryant as the NL MVP, and that's more on the lines of I don't think there is an easy standout candidate, like a clear like Mike Trout of the National League. So with that, I have to kind of lean towards a contributor on a good team. And I think Chris Bryant's going to be the best player on the lineup where he has protection, too, and that's part of it. Like, you can't be just the only threat or else you're not going to get enough quality pitches for you to be able to put the numbers you need up. I think Bryant has enough protection, and that team's going to win some games.
Going to the pitching category, Cy Young. We both have Clayton Kershaw. Both of us are out on a big limb there in the National League for Cy Young Award. Again, I like Houston. I picked Verlander as my Cy Young Award winner for the Astros, and you've gone with another guy that's been very, very good over the last few years as well.
Verlander is a Cy Young guy? Like, he old, man. Like, Verlander, he needs to have a throwback year. It's one thing for him to have a run like he did last year in the playoffs, but, like, it's not like he was a dependable pitcher last year.
I have a feeling he's going to find the fountain of youth.
Like, what is going to happen with Verlander? Like, that would be, to me, shocking if he's a Cy Young. But, hey, go bold, man. I respect it. Kershaw, if he's healthy, he's the best pitcher, and it's not even a question. The reason why he hasn't been the Cy Young the last couple of years is because he's had extended disabled list trips. Chris Sale is my American League guy. Strikeout guru. I know he had a little bit of a tweak in spring training. I think he missed a start or something like that. But he's set and ready to go for the start with the Red Sox. And it's hard for pitchers at Fenway Park to usually have a Cy Young type season. This is the way the ballpark's built, especially for a lefty like him. But last year, he was really good at Fenway Park as a left-handed pitcher, a strikeout guy. So if he kind of repeats it, gets a little bit more comfortable with the ballpark, a little bit more comfortable with the teams he's facing with the Red Sox, I think he takes a step up.
Both of us have a rookie manager, a manager that has never managed, not managed for somebody else in his debut with a new team, but both of us have a rookie manager taking home Manager of the Year awards. I have Aaron Boone in New York for the Yankees, winning Manager of the Year in the American League.
That's a good call with Aaron Boone, because if he's anywhere close to it, ESPN is going to hype him up to win the award because he is boys with everybody there who's involved with their baseball coverage. So that is a very good pick just based on narrative. I have Gabe Kapler for the Phillies because they're my surprise team in the National League. So AL Francona, I'm just going to go with wins there. I think the Indians are really good. He gets rewarded for kind of what he did last year. But Kapler is my NL guy.
And my NL guy is Bud Black. I have the Rockies going to the playoffs this year, squeezing in as a wild card. And I think you'll look at the other three teams and think they're stacked and figure that maybe he did something maybe a little better than some of the other managers. So I'm going to give the nod to Black in the National League. Now the home run leaders. We have four different players leading the league in home runs. I have Aaron Judge in the American League, and I have Nolan Arenado in the National League.
Coors Field advantage.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you're going with, Arenado? National League's tough with this, right? American League, I don't know what the odds are, but where the odds are is not a Yankees player.
Like, it's they got two guys that hit 50 last year.
Exactly. It's going to be Judge or Stanton, right? I don't know if you can project anybody else with any kind of level of confidence. Like, Trout doesn't hit home runs at that kind of pace. And I picked Stanton in the American League Fish. How would you feel about that? Just wondering. Your boy Stanton goes out and leads the league in home runs in the American League.
You know, I'm sure I would celebrate that because, like, at least I could say, you know, a former Marlin is succeeding.
Yeah, he ain't succeeding nowhere in your jersey.
As long as he doesn't hit more than last year, then I'll be fine with it.
I mean, he was on a disabled list for a good chunk of last year. How about Reese Hoskins leading the league in home runs in the National League? Because it's kind of open, right? Like, Arenado, he certainly has had some home run tallies within the last few years, but it's not like it's Stanton level. So I think this is open. And Bellinger, shouldn't he be somebody who's in the discussion? He had a bunch last year for the Dodgers. But nobody kind of hit him at the pace that Hoskins did when he was active and at the major league level. Now, maybe he has a bit of a sophomore slump, if you will, and the numbers go down. But he's had a good spring, too, especially lately, the last couple of weeks of it. So if he does what he did at the end of last year, he's a sleeper threat. I think that's a value pick.
And Fish, I'll give you something. We did not have Rookie of the Year on the list, but a lot of the publications that I've looked at touting the Marlins, Lewis Brinson in the outfield as Rookie of the Year in the National League.
Is he good?
Spring training stats. He hit 325 this year in spring training.
But Fish, is he good?
He's okay. I'm sure eventually, 6 years down the line, they'll trade him because he's too expensive. I already have that.
They got him in the Yelich deal from Milwaukee.
So yeah, I remember that. Yeah. 6 years down the line, he'll be a Yankee, a Philly. He'll be somebody.
No, it's a Yankee because Derek Jeter is a stealth scout for the Yankees. He's out here developing players on the Marlins just to trade them to the Yankees for them to get more championships.
For like a utility second baseman, yes, and some international bonus money.
That's exactly what Jeter is there for.
We didn't have this on the list to prepare for, so I'm going to catch you off guard. Is there a manager you think is the first one to get fired? I always love that every year.
Why do you love that? It's such a negative way. It's just a negative thought. I don't know, though.
Mattingly?
Who would you pick?
Yeah, Mattingly. He'll be the scapegoat. Jeter will say, oh, it's not our fault. It's Mattingly's fault.
Bruce Bochy.
No.
No. He could lose every game. He won 3 world championships. He'd retire before they'd fire him. No.
Craig Counsell just got there, but they spent a lot of money. Yeah, it was tough. Clint Hurdle. Pirates don't look good, maybe.
Hey, yeah, but their talents were. I mean, they traded Cole and McCutcheon. I mean, I don't know.
I can't pick teams that don't have talent.
I mean, I don't know.
And I can't pick teams that have talent. There's no right answer for this. You're the one who wanted the question. You need to come up with a definitive answer.
I said Mattingly.
All right, Mattingly.
I kind of agree with that. I mean, the Angels, you know what? Mike Socia could be the guy. He's been there a long time.
Yeah, there's been some discontent.
There
too.
Has been, and you've added Ohtani, you've added Upton, you've added some other people. You know, I've got them picked as a wild card this year. Maybe if you don't get off to a good start, maybe they think they need a new voice.
Yeah, that's a good pick, too.
Friday morning at 9 a.m., another good pick would be get $50 worth of gift certificates for only $25 to the Tortilla Factory Mexican Grill. It's home of Boise's only tortilla machine, guaranteeing you the freshest tortillas and Mexican food in the Treasure Valley. Friday morning at 9, go to KTIK.com and click on the Sweet Deals. Up next in the update, what coach doesn't think his former quarterback should be chosen number one by the Browns? We'll find out next on Sports Radio The Ticket.
Ticket Sports Update, sponsored by Peterson Auto Group. During the RX Madness sales event at Peterson Lexus, you'll save up to $4,000 on a new 2018 third row RXL, or at least a new one for only $375 a month. So during the RX Madness at Peterson Lexus. Well, you guys have given your picks for Major League Baseball, but Chris and I are both big into video games, so of course we had to incorporate some video games thanks to CBS Sports. They sim the season with MLB The Show 18. And Bob, you can rejoice. I'll see you in October because they have the Giants tying the Nationals for the best record in the NL.
Wow.
And they have them beating the Dodgers 4-3 in the NLCS and then cruising to a World Series title over the Twins 4-1.
Well, somebody needs to cool off Bob over here. He's a little hot right now.
Did they have somebody that was great at playing it for the Giants and that's why they won?
No, that was all the computer. They just simmed the whole season now. And Kelby Thompson, Bob, was your World Series MVP.
Kelby Tomlinson?
Yes. He hit 437 in the World Series.
Oh, my God.
Like I don't even want to call it. He's so happy right now. You should. I know this is radio, but if you could see his face.
Yeah.
He is so happy right now. I can't believe that.
So the Giants are going to beat the Dodgers for the National League Championship. They're going to beat the Twins in the World Series. Kelby Tomlinson is going to be. Kelby Tomlinson almost didn't make the team this coming out of spring.
Yeah, well, and they've had guys who weren't even on the team before the start of the year go out and wreck the Phillies in postseasons.
Yeah.
Cody Ross. Still bitter.
So there you go, Bob. That.
I mean, it's the show, by the way, where do you rank that in terms of sports video games, Fish?
Well, since it's considering it's the only baseball game, it's worth mentioning. It's the number one baseball game, but after that,
well,
it's...
Thanks for the obvious statement.
You're welcome. You're welcome. I could be a head coach of any team you need me to be. I would say it's probably third, behind Madden and 2K. It's ahead of hockey, mainly because I don't play hockey.
What about FIFA, though? I think FIFA has to be above the show. The show's really good, though.
The show loses points because I can't play it, because it's PlayStation exclusive.
It's PlayStation.
If I was owned a PlayStation, I'd put it third. I'm not a big... I don't like soccer video games. They're about as boring as soccer in real life. Just faster.
And I wasn't shocked when I asked you guys if you guys ever played Strat-O-Matic, which is the game with the dice, and you look at the playing, the cards, the computerized cards. I'm sure there's a few listeners out there that have played Strat-O-Matic like I have. But you guys looked at me like, what are you talking about?
The old...
Well, opening day of baseball, we just talked about it a day away, and... Bob, well, maybe this will be your metaphor for the Dodgers. Maybe this is why the Giants beat them in the show. Yesterday, they had a spring training game against the Angels. That game called after five innings after a sewer line in the stadium backed up and some excess waste drained onto the field.
And that's something that happened, I believe, at the A's, didn't it, a few years ago? It was in the clubhouse.
Yep, I remember that, yeah.
Excess waste? I thought you were talking about Clayton Kershaw. I thought that was going to be the joke that Bob had, calling Clayton Kershaw excess waste. But nope. He's too nice.
And one more baseball note. If you want to see Shohei Ohtani pitch, you're going to need to wait till Sunday. The Angels have announced he'll start the year fourth of the rotation. He'll pitch the opening series finale against the A's on Sunday. There's been no plans yet announced for when he will appear as a DH for the team.
They're not planning on using him in the outfield, I take it?
No. At least not before Sunday.
I think his impact this year is going to be on the mound more than on the plate.
Yeah, his impact will be, you know, other teams impacting the baseball into the stands. And that's what seems like is happening so far. There's other teams leaving an impact on the baseball that he threw. And if you're bad, is that an impact?
Like, you know, especially if you overpay.
You're out here pitching and you're giving up a lot of hits. You're making an impact. It's called a negative impact. So, you know, whatever he gets to do more, he'll make an impact.
I think he will be a better pitcher than a hitter this year.
I think he'll get more opportunities to be a routine pitcher than a routine hitter. I think that's probably the best way to put it.
And I think the Angels, they've got what? In that DH slash whatever position, Pujols is there. I think the better Pujols, the better some of those older veterans do for the Angels, the less opportunity he'll have either.
Will Pujols continue to be the worst player in baseball, or do you think he'll be a little bit better?
Saw him last night. Looked like a little fitter this year. I think he may be better this year than he was last year. But that doesn't say that much.
He was in Baseball Reference, I think, or maybe 538 had a stat of there's never been a player who was at one point the best player in baseball.
According to WAR.
Worst player in baseball. Yeah, he was in WAR. He was... Yeah. Literally had a peak of the best, and then was at one point the worst.
Well, you guys are talking about opportunities. Only one quarterback's going to have the opportunity to go number one in the draft to the Cleveland Browns, and it's time for coaches to start hyping their guys up. Now, former UCLA head coach Jim Mora Jr., he's now an analyst for the NFL Network. He was on, and he was asked, who should the Browns take at number one? Your man Josh Rosen, or perhaps the guy across the bay, Sam Darnold? This is what he had to say.
I'll tell you this. Because of fit.
Yeah.
I would take Sam Darnold if I were the Cleveland Browns. You know, I think that that blue-collar, gritty attitude, I think his teammates will love him. I think the city will love him. He'll say the right things. He'll come in and he'll represent well. I think he kind of represents what Cleveland is. And then if I was one of the New York teams, I'd take Josh like that. I think they're both going to be great pros.
I have a question. Does Mora coach again? Does anybody in the NFL or major college football hire Jim Mora as a coach?
Yeah, I think so. And he's got connections. You know, that family's been around the game for such a long time that I feel like he's not going to be left out in the cold. Where I sit on this is, well, Jim Mora, former coach, now you work for the NFL Network, so you can say what you want as an analyst. You're not the Brian Kelly where you're out here criticizing Deshaun Kizer and wait a minute. You've made how much money off of DeShone Kizer helping you get wins? You saved your job because DeShone Kizer's out here getting wins, and now you're going to rip him on the way out and say he's not ready for the NFL? No, your responsibility is to prop him up, even if you don't believe it. Your responsibility as his coach is to say nice things. Not exactly the same description as Mora, but I'm interested in, like, he said that he doesn't fit because of blue collar and grittiness and those kind of things. Like, how much are you weighing that versus, like, the best player? Like, would you really turn down the best player in the draft because of a lack of blue collarness or grittiness?
I think it would be why you wouldn't think he'd be as successful in Cleveland would be, I don't know. Does you think he...
You watched the film and you came to the conclusion that Josh Rosen was the better one. I'm not saying that is what, but like, let's say as a hypothetical, you watched the film and Josh Rosen is significantly, you know.
Okay.
Yeah, it just popped. Wow, he is the best quarterback here. You are really not going to take him because of a lack of blue collarness? You're Cleveland. Your culture has been losing losses. You need to get the most talented guy you have in the building. That should be your number one concern, and figure out your team around that guy. You don't have the luxury of trying to bring in people to fit your culture when you don't have a winning culture. You need talent. So, I don't know, that's where I sit from the Cleveland
perspective.
Do you think
right now, coming into this thing, that there's that much difference between the quarterbacks they've talked? I mean, there may end up being that, but I don't know. Do you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a film guy. That's why we have draft experts on to break this down and tell us from the NFL standpoint. I mean, I can have my opinion in saying that I think Rosen, and I've been, you know, just by watching college football, I would have picked Rosen number one. I think he's been more productive than the other two by far. I mean, Darnold's out here throwing more interceptions than Eli Manning in bad years. Josh Allen wasn't any good. Like, so maybe it's tough for me to say, but like, Lamar Jackson's been more productive than most of those guys. Lamar Jackson out here with a Heisman. Now I see why his style of play wouldn't translate, but I can't say the same thing about Rosen. His style of play is good. He showed a level of competitiveness with UCLA that I like. I've heard quotes from Josh Rosen that show me that he's a very intelligent guy who thinks about things very logically and critically, which I think is, you know, what I would want. So I would pick him, but I'm not a draft guy.
Well, in the sports update, baseball new season about to start, but if we all remember last year, there were sort of reports that maybe the MLB had doctored the balls a little bit, add some home runs in the postseason. It seems the NFL might have taken a page out of that playbook, altering some rules when it came to their playoffs, well, mainly just the Super Bowl. It's reported today by ESPN's Chris Mortensen and Sal Palantonio that the new catch rule that the league just approved was actually used during the Super Bowl and the Eagles win over the Patriots, and that both reviewed touchdowns for the Eagles, the Clement touchdown and the, what's the tight end's name again? Ertz. The Ertz touchdown. Both of them, basically, the NFL was legislating on the seat of their pants on the fly, adapting a rule in the game.
You can't be doing that.
And it wasn't voted on yet?
No. That was the rule that they just passed 2 days ago. Mm. Which I guess would explain why Chris Collinsworth was wrong on every single one, because the NFL had a new rule nobody knew about.
It's all of a sudden changed to the rules on the fly to benefit the Eagles. I'm not necessarily complaining, but no, I just thought those were catches. Like, in the Super Bowl, both of those plays that you're talking about, those were catches. So, say what you want about past interpretations or rulings. I watched those live and thought those were catches, and there's no way that you can overturn these.
And I think that was the one thing the NFL did not want to have happen, to have a Super Bowl decided on something that they called no catch, that the public would think was a catch.
Especially the Ertz one.
The Ertz one was a touchdown.
Yeah. Ertz caught the ball at the 6.
Yeah.
Ertz was a guaranteed touchdown.
If you called that incomplete when he caught the ball at the 6 and ran to the end zone and reached out, the level of outrage coming from Philadelphia, I don't think the NFL still would have recovered from it.
I agree with Ertz. Yes, Chris. Clement, I think you was a little closer than you'll admit. But Ertz, if you called that an incomplete, I was about to just leave my Super Bowl party with the host because they were reviewing that. But
oh, well. We'll see if the new rules are happier for fans to try to figure out what is a catch and what's not. Final Four Saturday, coming to Sports Radio The Ticket. The incredible Loyola Chicago story continues at 4 as the Ramblers take on Michigan, immediately followed by Kansas and Villanova. Final Four on Sports Radio The Ticket. That Saturday, national championship game Monday. Tip will be at 7:20. If you can't watch, listen right here on The Ticket. Coming up next, what did we learn in today's Idaho Sports Talk with Bob and Chris? Talk college basketball. Heard from Coach Rice when he appeared with Caves and Prater yesterday and also made our baseball picks. So what did we learn? That's next on Sports Radio, The Ticket. $1,000. That's like 100 six-packs. Your shot at one grand. Four times every weekday, 7 a.m., 10 a.m., 1 p.m., and 4 p.m. All you have to do is text the keyword in. Remember, though, don't text and drive. 4K a day will start tomorrow at 7 a.m. on Sports Radio, The Ticket.
It's time to find out what we learned on Idaho Sports Talk with Bob and Chris. Brought to you by Pro-Am Sports, your full-service pro shop and bowling specialist with high-quality bowling balls, bags, and accessories located right inside Westie's Garden Lanes in Garden City. We're sort of reviewing the Leon Rice cut from yesterday when he was on with Caves and Prater. We got a tweet in from Peter Lenderson on Twitter. Said, he asked you guys, why would Boise State be interested in hosting the NCAA tournament when it prevents an NIT home game? Of course, remember Boise State as the lower seed had to travel to UW, lost that game, when it means far less fans will travel if BSU gets into the NCAA tournament, and the only benefit would be more season ticket holders.
I think the benefits are many, and I think that when you look at an NIT, first of all, you're hoping that you're in the NCAA tournament, which means you won't be playing at home anyway. It's unfortunate, and I do think Boise State would have won the game if it was at home. I don't think you pass on an NCAA tournament host just for the opportunity that you might lose for hosting an NIT game. Who knows? You might not be good enough to even make the NIT, or you might be better in being in the NCAA tournament.
Now, as a follow-up statement or additional question to it, how do you think if Boise State would have made the NCAA tournament, how hosting games in Boise would have affected the travel for people who would go to see Boise State wherever that they would have ended up? Let's say Boise State played in San Diego, which is another option. How do you think it would have affected, you know, the fact that Boise was hosting? Probably that meant fewer people would have traveled to see Boise State play in San Diego,
yeah,
right?
Although you don't get that many tickets, the number of tickets given to each team. So I think you'd probably have some people that would have had to make the choice of going to the games in, say, San Diego or Dallas or wherever you had been assigned, or stay and go to the games here. It's expensive. You get a quick turnaround. The announcement is what, Sunday?
Yeah.
And you know you're going to whatever city Sunday night, so you're looking at probably 3-day advance purchase on the airline, not cheap. And I think you would have had maybe a couple people that would have said, no, I'm not going, and then a couple of people would have, maybe decided to stay because they had NCAA tournaments, but I don't know that it would have made that much difference one way or the other.
Regardless, the city certainly benefits when you can get all those out-of-town people here for a weekend of NCAA tournament. Like, the city was absolutely popping, and that was great to see. So, regardless of the effect for Boise State, Pro Archon,
it was
the effect for the city was, really, really good.
It's too bad that last year, this year, draw in the NIT wasn't flipped. Last year we didn't host it, and we were on the road at Utah. This year we should have hosted it and had to go to Washington. If it had been flipped, it would have been perfect.
And then real quick, you guys gave your baseball predictions. Just a quick rundown. You guys all have Nationals, Cubs, Dodgers winning in the NL in their divisions, Yankees, Indians, Astros. Chris had the Phillies and the Cardinals in the wild card, Bob the Brewers and the Dodgers. Chris had Red Sox, Twins, Bob Red Sox, Angels. But I didn't get a World Series prediction. So before we get to JP, what's next on Caves and Prater? What do we got in the World Series, guys? Come on.
I've got the Astros against the Cubs with the Astros winning, but I could change to Cubs winning if they make a deadline deal for a closer. I don't think Brandon Morrow is quite as good a closer as they would like to proceed in postseason.
Dodgers, Indians. That's where we're going. What? That made sense. JP, by the way, in the building. What's up?
I was a little bit concerned when I stepped in here earlier, and during the commercial break, Bob's sole focus was on which baseball game are we going to get in here tomorrow afternoon?
Which game will it be? That's the life of Bob, just figuring out what baseball games are on.
You have the package, Bob. You can watch anything you want.
I do. But I just was wondering if we had a TV on here, what the TV would be showing.
Well, imagine if golf was on at the same time and somebody tried to throw on golf the same day it was opening day. JP. Because you probably would.
Well, I can tell you that next week, nobody will get control of the TV while I watch the Masters as much as possible.
Well, 1-3 will have control of 1-3.
Why don't we have a reality show or an online show about control of the remote And like, I feel like that is a saga that is really not known to the audience outside of this building, of the power that that remote control has and the battle for who gets to watch what they want to watch.
It's always a battle for the remote. We've got it on this side, so we're in control. But coming up in our college football hour today, we're going to take a look at the Big Sky Conference. You know, Jeff Caves played in the Big Sky.
Yeah. Was he all conference?
What's that?
Was he all conference?
No, he wasn't all conference. Are you kidding me? He was in the conference. He wasn't
I thought you conference. Said he was all conference. I'm sorry.
But we're going to be joined by Dan Hawkins, UC Davis head coach, and also Idaho State coach. He's been there for this going into second year, I believe, Rob Fennessy. So we're going to talk about Big Sky Conference football at 4 o'clock.
And, of course, Idaho going in there for the first time in a while. Sure. Montana is usually one of the better teams in that league. Jeff Choate, former Boise State assistant at Montana State. I think it's one of the better FCS leagues in the country.
Yeah, it's now got a new member, which looks to do some damage in it with Idaho. And all right, so this is the last, 15 seconds of the show that won't have baseball on it for the next 2 days.
Right. I'll be distracted probably a little bit tomorrow. See how distracted I get. Come back 1-3 tomorrow. Giants don't play till 5, so I won't be overly distracted. Caves and Prater coming up next. Again, Chris and I back tomorrow at 1 on Sports Radio, The Ticket.
Sports Radio 93.1 FM and 1350 AM, The Ticket.